You're listening to Taking Care of Business, and I'm Rob Rose.
I'm Juliette Talevi, and every week, this is where you'll get the backstory to what you read in the Financial Mail and on Business Day.
We also want to know what you'd like to know, who you want to hear from, and what you'd like to hear about. So please get in touch with us and email us at tcb@businesslive.co.za.
So this week, we figured with Group 5, the latest construction sector stalwart to succumb to South Africa's version of Chapter 11 bankruptcy, we'd speak to the company that was the first to go, and that is Basil Reed. It was placed in business rescue last year. It was felled by a combination of debt, lack of finance, loss-making contracts, and we have to say an unsupportive government. Now, Ketu Mapasa has been Basil Reed's CEO since October 2017, and he joins us in studio. Ketu, thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
I suppose just to start, I mean, it's really intriguing to be running a company that's in business rescue. How does that practically work? I mean, what is it? What actually happens on a day-to-day basis?
So perhaps I, it's not Chapter 11, right? It's Chapter 6 of the Company Act in South Africa. And there's something to talk about, you know, the difference between Chapter 11 and what we have as a dispensation in South Africa. But that for another day, right?
Or maybe just a little bit later in the podcast.
Yeah. So if, you know, the way the law works is that the business rescue practitioners are the ultimate decision makers in replacement of the board and management. So to make it very simple, my board right now are the business rescue practitioners. And Basil Reed, there are two business rescue practitioners, that being Siviwe Dongwana and John Lightfoot. So they are my bosses, if you can't call it. So the ultimate decision makers.
So you have no real executive authority right now?
Well, that's the ultimate executive authority, and fiduciary authority is with the business rescue practitioners. There's a reason for that, because ultimately they take the fiduciary responsibility of the company. This is actually an instrument of the law. Chapter 6 says they are actually in their own personal capacity, just like if you have a normal company with directors, you can actually, you need to stand for those fiduciary duties, right? So they ultimately make the decisions that can be challenged in court. So they need to be in charge. So, and that's how it works. But practically, you know, business rescue practitioners are what I call bin counters. They know nothing about construction.
So you're saying that you're finance directors?
Well, they're a little bit more than that. But the deep knowledge of construction is with us, the existing management. So in effect, because this is a voluntary business rescue, it's actually a partnership relationship. So we work together. I'm on the phone if I cannot see them every day. You know, most of the time we are executing my recommendations in that sense, because I understand the industry better. We might be trying to solve a problem that, you know, they look at me and say, what's the best way forward in this?
So one thing I've always found interesting is a lot of companies go into business rescue, but few emerge from this process. You look at Stutterfords, you look at so many of them that have ended up here. I mean, what are the odds that business rescue can actually work in this case? And why doesn't it work in so many cases? Is it just that the companies are already on their deathbed?
Yeah, part of it is that. And you also have to remember, Rob, this is very new in South Africa. I think this part of the Act came into effect around 2011. So we don't have a long history like the U.S. where, you know, Chapter 11 is understood. So you can think General Motors 2009, General Motors is still around. Mm. There is an infrastructure that supports Chapter 11. One of the important thing is around what they call post-commencement finance, right? There are industries that are looking after, financial industries that looks after just post-commencement finance in the jurisdictions that like the U.S. In South Africa, it's not true. So you have the traditional banks, you know, in terms of their risk assessment, they're not predisposed as the same as if you're dealing with a financial distress company. So it makes for a very challenging issue. So one of the key success around business rescue is securing post-commencement finance. The other issue is that you cannot use business rescue to avoid paying your creditors. So if you are in deep trouble, you're better off actually going for liquidation rather than, you know, business rescue. Because quite often, what I've been told many times is that you have companies that are very, very sick and they use business rescue to avoid, their liquidation, or they go into business rescue too late. And that therein lies, the seeds of failure of business rescue.
I mean, one of the things is, if you're an executive, you run a company, you're almost predestined to believe that your company is always going to survive. You have a sort of an inclination towards optimism, so you would generally favor going in too late, I suppose. And generally, isn't that part of the psychology of running a business? You always think things are going to improve sooner rather than later.
Indeed. I mean, I think corporate hubrism, it's part of the nature. I think sometimes the boards of various companies, and I've got the privilege of sitting on a number of other boards, private companies. When you sit there and you're a non-executive director, you have to make the ultimate decision around whether you go into business rescue, and you're listening to a CEO who's saying, things are going to come right. And therein lies, I think, another story for construction companies. I was speaking earlier about why did we end up in this space? I think the optimism was there, and you have to have optimism. And I think it's part of, being a CEO. So, construction industry before 2010, it was a boom. Everyone was building. We were pushing projects away. We were worried about not having capacity. And since then, government infrastructure spend has declined in real terms. I mean, it's not a secret. Government is running out of money. So there's less and less projects remaining. So what do? We end up undercutting each other in terms of pricing. So you end up securing projects at 0% margins.
Just so you basically keep your staff
keep
employed.
Your capacity, because you've got this optimism that construction is going to come back. And it hasn't come back for the last 8 years. You can't sustain that. If it's a year deep, yes, that strategy can work. But if it's prolonged, like what we've seen, and that's exactly where we ended up. And that's the genesis, in my view, of where we've ended up in terms of, being financially distressed.
So how sick is or was Basil Reed going for voluntary business rescue? Would you say you had a case of business measles, or was it terminal?
No, our view is that, if you look at our 2017 results that we published around about May 2018, we lost just over R1 billion, and that was our second.
That's a fraction of Eskom. You guys could think
But that number on a R6 billion turnover, it's
crushing.
It's,
and
it's a disaster.
And
right?
Your liabilities were way in excess of your assets as well.
But before that, what we had done is that we had secured a bridging facility. That's one of the tasks that I was involved in when I first became acting CEO in June 2017 with the IDC. And we had said we need to repay that 150 bridging loan either from the proceeds of the rights offer or the sale of what we have identified as non-core assets. What we did is that we were successful with the rights offer, and our shareholders really came to the party because they could see within Basil Reed there were construction was a sick business.
Yeah.
But within Basil Reed, we've got another business called the mining services business, and we also have a development services business. And those businesses have been profitable. And if we could use the turnaround plan has always been to wind out those construction contracts that have been losing money. And that was the reason for the bridge. And the shareholders came in with more money.
It was 300 million rand.
300 million rand. But I suppose in hindsight, it's a perfect science. And I'm looking at it personally as a lesson and saying, we paid back the 150 million bridge. So when we went into business rescue, we were looking just before that for 115 million that we have already repaid. I think for me, the genius would have been not paying back the 150, using it as a working capital to continue to wind down those construction business, and then you use the proceeds of sale of the non-core assets to repay the bridge loan. Mm-hmm. Because what then happened, when as soon as we went into business rescue, we had a non-core asset that was going to be sold on auction on the 23rd, I think, of June. We went into business rescue on the 15th of June. And everyone, you know, we thought, you know, we were going to get the number, the reserve price that we could. And then the day before, you know, the auction, we got news that, you know, there are no interested buyers. So we had to withdraw this because everyone now perceives, you know, Basil Reed is actually in business rescue. It probably means if I hold back, I can get this from a fire sale. So perception is very, very important. And you know, that's where we are.
I was going to ask, you talk of the fact that the companies undercut each other. It's difficult to assess how this will happen because it's Group 5 as well in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
It's Esau. There are a whole lot of companies that are struggling and really seem to be in the last legs. The industry seems on its last legs. And people often talk about government infrastructure spending having completely plummeted. But to what extent is the industry culpable for this? To what extent is it an own goal? And where were those own goals versus what government did?
Precisely that. I mean, the job of executive is to read the market.
Did the executives not do that?
I can say this, you know, my fellow peers in the industry can chase me down. I don't think we all, I think we believe too much that this infrastructure spend is going to come back. So undercutting each other was, you know, the order of the day. The trouble with that is that projects by its own nature for construction, actually something will go wrong. So the design is not always what you hit when you're building a road, for example. So it gives rise to what we call variations. It end up in a claim. The claim process is so protracted where you don't have margins, or, you know, you are in trouble very, very quickly.
I mean, this, yeah.
So that's part of the reason, Rob, where, you know, we are very culpable. I'm admitting that we are culpable of that, not being able to read that. So firstly, I think what we were saying in our turnaround is that, you know, no project will be tendered at less than, you know, a certain margin percentage. So we brought in a rule, and lo and behold, we never secured any more work.
Because the other guys are still undercutting it.
Yeah.
So, but then what do you do at that point?
So, I mean, I think it's not, you have to now cut your cloth to fit, right? So you have to reduce your own capacity if the market is to continue not to accept your service. I've also seen in situations where, you know, clients will accept your bid because they believe in your quality. You've got a track record with them rather than the lowest bid. You know, so you've got to believe in yourself as well sometimes. And I think sometimes we lost that to say, well, we became very desperate, you know, as an industry to say, you know, we're just going to, I mean, before I became the group CEO of Basil Reed, when I was running the mining business, this is very normal in the contract mining service, and where, you know, the client will say, do this additional work for me. And I'll give him, for example, 100. And he says, no, there's somebody else who can do it for 70. I said, the best I can do is 95.
Yeah.
And the client will say, well, but you could, I said, no, I'm not, never. But then, you know, they go back and they say, you know, you've got it for 95. At least I've protected my bottom line. And the client has got a responsibility to reduce their own cost. So it's a negotiation process. But we sort of capitulate too early.
Yeah. I mean, just going back to the issue of contracts that turn into these terrible, nightmarish, loss-making contracts that end up in claims and protracted disputes, why is it that it happens so often?
Like Crescent Helena Airport, right?
I mean, was that one of the examples that ended up in disputes?
No.
You know, is it because you're over optimistic in the beginning and you tender and you say this is our design and this is how it's going to work out? Is it a lack of work done up front? What is it?
So I think there's a few things, right? So if you look at a project value chain, where we sit as construction companies, usually we are doing the construction on a design that somebody else done. So up front, there's somebody who's called a consultant or engineer who did the design. And Centrelina is a very good example where we actually designed, build, operate, and we had a handover after 10 years. So we could actually design for constructability because we've got the skills in-house to do that. Most other contracts are just construction only. And you've got a design engineer who's your manager on the other side. So if there is a design flaw, he's actually not very, you know, turkeys don't vote for Christmas, right? So he's not going to admit easily that he's made a mistake. So that's what ends up happening. And that's one sort of pathology in the industry, in the broader industry. The second one is don't underestimate the fact that our clients have got no money. I'm talking government. So the longer they drag things on in the claim process because their budgets are not allocated, the better for them.
I wanted to ask just one thing quickly. In terms of the Sandton, you look at Sandton, you walk through Sandton in Joburg, and there's a thousand myriad of projects taking place.
Yeah.
Why is it that our construction companies are falling apart when there is actually building taking place in the country? Who's doing this? Why can we not? We see massive building, and yet our construction companies are falling over the whole time.
You know, it's a very interesting mystery. And Julieta asked me earlier, you know, before this, about the, the iconic building for Basil Reed. You probably have never seen Basil Reed in Sandton, even during the boom. Basil Reed is not a traditional builder. We grew up building roads. So, you know, airports and the like. So we don't have that presence in that space.
The Gauteng Freeway project.
Our competitors, yes, indeed. Our competitors are a lot more disposed to that space. And that's a private market. But that private market is not sufficient, in my view, to cover everyone in the construction industry.
Yeah.
So government, by its nature, must come into the space. So you might see a construction boom in Sandton, maybe in Cape Town foreshore, but that's small compared to the industry capacity that's there.
Yeah. We've got Siseko Njobeni, who's been sitting with us in studio. Siseko, of course, writes on matters construction, trade and industry for Business Day and Financial Mail. Siseko, you've got a question for K2.
Yes. K2, you mentioned government contracts. I'd like to know, what are the profile of your contracts at the time when you went into Business Rescue, and what has happened to those contracts?
So, you know, just roughly numbers, probably 80% of our contracts are with government or some sort of a government-related institution, state-owned enterprise. So by far, Basil Reed is construction is involved with government in some form or another. So we had 25 contracts. Today, where we sit, we've got about 6 contracts that are left. Because what has happened is we've completed some of the contracts. Some of the contracts we've cancelled because the clients are not paying us. So the contract provides for termination by us. And some of the contracts have been terminated by the client because we are in business rescue. Centrelina being a very good example.
Yeah. You must have watched Webstem Febe earlier on ENCA this week, and Webstem Febe is the CEO of the South African Forum of Civil Engineering Contractors.
Indeed.
He appealed to government to intervene to stop what is now being called the construction mafia. And I spoke to Skumbuzo Makozoma at SANRAL last year about, and I think the genesis was amendments to regulations, was it the PPPFA?
Yes.
Where construction companies have become obliged to cut in local contractors. And now this has opened up this nightmarish scenario where you get site invasions, local guys coming into a project, halting it, using, you know, they're armed, they use violence to get their way because they want a cut of the project. This is Webster and Fairbear talking on ENCA, and we just thought we would play this, and also the ripple effect that this is happening on confidence and on skills in the industry.
The two projects, the Mtendu Bridge, there's a German company in partnership with Avenge that is pulling out. I think they are battling it out in court. And in the Eastern Cape last week, 13th of March, a 2.4 billion rand private investment project of a German an investor being built by WBHO was disrupted. Female engineers crying, going into the felt, saying, I will never come back into this country, we need to leave. Already we have 110 known, not known, engineers that have left the country. And once the construction industry loses that capacity, like the rest of Africa, foreigners are going to build the infrastructure. Those engineers are going to come back here with foreign companies that double the cost because we'll not have that capacity to build the infrastructure in the country.
I mean, that's a state of crisis. And so there's two aspects there, a loss of skills that hollows out capacity almost permanently. Yeah. And the fact that the construction, the state construction sector seems to be in the hands of a mafia.
Indeed. I mean, what Webster is talking about there, you know, giving examples there, we've had our fair share in many of our projects. I can think about, you know, just here in Gauteng, we've got a developments project in near Vereeniging called Savannah City, where, you know, I got this distress call. The employees were in holed up in the police station because people have invaded the space. Exactly that, you know, this local procurement. I don't think those regulations are fully understood, and they are elements of criminality that are using the opportunity because of lack of clarity around those 30% local. But what is it? Is it, what is local? My understanding is, you know, South Africa is local, right?
Yeah.
And you've got to have the skills to be able to participate in that 30%. This notion of saying we are entitled to 30%, but 30% to do what? To just take the money. I've already told you that.
What would you do for that?
You know, I've already told you that we are running on very thin margins. So the margin of error is very small. So you can't have somebody, you can't carry passengers.
But
right?
Now you need a supportive state to say, okay, this is a crisis. We've got to step in and give clarity and get security services to, or the police to do their jobs. But that doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, I think it's a lot bigger than that. I think it's a political problem because I think it's a social dialogue problem because, I mean, I just have to remind you of what happened in Marikana when you have a sort of a police issue. I think the industry, when I talk about the industry, community and everyone, we need to come together and actually understand that because, yes, you can have a solution that says, you know, police intervention, they come with guns, as Webster mentioned, that people come with rifles. And we've had the same example. So when you have people with rifles and you have police coming in with rifles,
No one wants to work there.
No. It's, you know, for us poor engineers, it's pretty scary. But so that's why I'm saying we got to elevate this a lot higher than just a police intervention because, you know, the consequences of not taking it that serious, it's you know, we don't want another Marikana situation. So I really think, you know, we need leadership at all levels, all of us. I think there was a CEFSEC conference or, you know, one of the legal firms put together to discuss some of these issues around construction industry and where do we go from here. And I think the lack of dialogue, you know, upfront dialogue to say we're going to do this in this community and getting the community and involved upfront and, you know, setting expectations. It's a bit of an Achilles heel for us. But unfortunately, I think we are caught as South Africa, the, you know, the downgrade and everything else, you know, it's like a bit of a, you know, a bit of a feeding frenzy. There's no one who's willing to take a bit of pain or step back and say, let's do things
for the good.
It's like, how do I get to the end quickly, you know? Take my cut. You know, we're fighting over a shrinking pie, and that's to me is the sad part.
So you talk of the lack of leadership, politicians as well as I suppose the industry as well, not taking up the mantle and doing something about it. But I mean, in terms of this industry, is it for investors? I mean, investors, these companies have been listed on the JSE for ages. Is there any solution in the long run? It sounds like it's uninvestable for the moment. There are these kind of crises which are just making it worse. Never mind the existing state of the contracts.
But look, I mean, I'm going to sound like an optimist again. I mean, we
someone's got to be.
This country has to do infrastructure expenditure. You know, it's unfortunate. Most of these companies, all of us, are experiencing deep financial distress at the moment. But when that does come back, you know, surely for the investors, there must be something. But you've got to be in a situation where you've got that, you know, Warren Buffett says you got to be, you know, greedy when everyone is running away, and you got to be, you know, that whole kind of concept. This is why you take my point earlier on when I spoke about business rescue and the lack of a fund or financial institutions that are just focused on specializing in that space. And that's where I see an opportunity to say those investors who are able to identify those assets, perhaps consolidate and be very focused, you know, they stand to benefit in the future.
So to play devil's advocate on this, is it not a good thing that some companies collapse, because then it brings pricing power back to the remaining players? They can price the contracts properly, make an investable sector again and grow it again.
Precisely. I think it's capitalism, right? that's exactly what...
Creative destruction.
Creative destruction. And that's... We've got to get better in that as an industry, you know, individual players in the industry, to understand, you know, strategy, which is about competition. And it's about outperforming your competitor in a lawful way, right? So that's really what it is. So those who are remaining standing will have that pricing power.
Do you think there'll be skills left enough to do... And you say when the industry surely comes back. I mean, is it a case of when, or is it actually a case of if at this point?
We have it. It's when. Really, I think when we sort out our financial situation as a country, I think, you know, we can't run away from infrastructure spend. I mean, this weekend, I drove to my home province in Limpopo. You know, water, simple. It's, you know, maybe you're sitting here in Johannesburg, you think it's a
given.
You open the tap and it goes. But just remind you, Cape Town. You know, the drought spawned out desalination. Who's doing that? Construction companies, right? So there are those opportunities. These roads, they have to be built. I mean, I was again in Limpopo. There are places where road infrastructure is needed, absolutely needed.
Maybe just one last point. Ketso Gordon, when he was CEO of PPC, called for a sort of an infrastructure CODESA. I always thought it was a great idea. He also talked about really standardizing schools, clinics. You have kind of a one model, and you divvy it up, get the construction companies to build it. Do you think that's what we need? Do you talk about dialogue, all parties coming together? Could you guys push for that? Do you think there's support for it?
Precisely. I think there's a Presidential Infrastructure Commission, I think.
But that's been around for ages. And what's it doing?
Precisely. I mean, I think we are all disappointed, because we certainly had different expectations of what has transpired. And I think that's where it starts. I mean, I think government has to take lead. I mean, it's not a secret. You go to China or you go to the U.S., you've got these big construction companies that travel with the president. I mean, that's what it's all about. And precisely when you come back to what you're saying, Ketso has said, you know, we've got industry bodies like SAFSEC. you know, we've got the voluntary rebuild program, which following the Competition Commission things, we're sitting and we are having discussions. I mean, Minister Patel, you know, in the beginning of the year, we had one of those dialogues. And those ideas are coming and are there. There's a infrastructure fund that government has committed 100 billion over a number of years, and they want to attract private infrastructure funds into it. Those are the ideas that we need to make into fruition to really, I mean, it's not just about construction companies, it's about the country. That's what's important, yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of your company now, I mean, Basil Reed's been an institution for, you know, 60, 67 years or so. I mean, what are the odds that it's really going to come out of Business Rescue now, and where are you in the process? And I suppose as a last point, I wanted to ask, what's the biggest lesson you've learned being in Business Rescue?
So I think the business rescue practitioners still continue to believe there is a reasonable prospect, despite many, many challenges. And I never really got to cover some of the challenges around. Maybe I'll cover from the lessons that I've learned around business rescue. So there's a reasonable prospect of Basil Reed being successfully rescued. The law talks about Part A and Part B of rescue. So you can either wind down the business and you get a better dividend for the creditors than you would have in liquidation, or you restructure the company going forward. And I think where we are going with Basil Reed is that construction, we're going to reduce that to minimum. And the idea is that we're going to be left with one or two projects and, you know, pay back our debt, get to a point where you get pay off the dividend, and then you can continue trading. You have, as I said, two other businesses that are successful, and releasing that is part of the business rescue plan to say protect the value in those businesses and continue to trade with like that. So that's where we are going. So we're going to be quite small in construction or to nothing, because we have to, its nature is those construction projects are losing money, right? So you can't continue to fund it. So you've got to find a way to complete it. Or terminate, get that contract terminated. Unfortunately, what that means is that we have to retrench those people, right? Because we don't have ready projects where we've secured work. Because when you go into business rescue, you cannot comply in any of the tenders. You can't raise a performance guarantee because no one will give it to you. You probably don't have the tax clearance because you're behind. So a bit of a chicken and egg there. So until you get to a point where you've satisfied all your creditors, you can't really declare victory in terms of business rescue. So personally, what have I learned?
To stay away from construction.
Yeah, I know my family asked me what have I been thinking, because I'm a newbie in this industry, relative. I used to work for a very long time. For Anglo American, which is, it's got its own challenges in mining.
Are you an engineer?
I'm an engineer. Funny enough, I'm a chemical engineer, which is, so you could ask me what am I doing in construction. I've learned business in a very different way, because what it has become, it's about cash. You know the adage, revenue is vanity. Profit is a bit of sanity, and then cash is reality. And the way we've been running the business is about cash on a daily basis, even an hourly basis, right? But it taught me lessons where I wouldn't have learned those lessons in a big construction company that has been successful, or like a big mining house, because I'm making decisions or getting involved in the granular details. You get into ask questions like, are you paying security services for this much, you know, and you have four security guards, but you know the building is empty, maybe you can get away with one. You know, it's that granular. So I it's almost like I tell people, we're disassembling this business that has been together for such a long time. Then you get to understand the controls, who puts in the order for this. Should they put in an order? Because you get situations where people are saying, well, I've got to get the cement here. I've got to buy in bulk. But I've driven past some of these projects sometimes when we're building a road. We've got bags and bags of cement. you ask the question, when is this cement going to be? No, we're going to use it in 2 months' time. But why did you buy it now?
Hmm.
Because somebody is going to come and steal it. Because, you know, you're building roads in, you know, so it's those lessons. I mean, I've learned a lot more about business than what I learned when I went to Harvard Business School. And I really mean it, because it's very theoretical when you talk sure. finances and all of those things. When it's real.
Should we recommend that every CEO goes through business risk?
I will really, you have to have the stomach for it. It's very stomach churning, because you know, it's not about things are going to go wrong. It's like when things are go wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And how you recover and you react to it. So you get a client who promise you, I'm going to pay you tomorrow, and they don't pay you. And you're depending on that cash flow to pay someone wages else. And salaries. Mm-hmm. And you're no longer able to honor that. And that gets very personal. So for me, that has been a very key lesson. And one last issue, your people. People, you know, you hear business schools talk about people are their most important assets. I tell you, when you're in the trenches in business rescue, you actually learn who are with you, who are the people with you, who are not with you. And because corporate politics disappear very quickly.
Hmm. Yeah.
You are exposed. So you learn very quickly who are the people who are managing you, Mr. CEO, you're the big guy, and they're telling you nice stories. And those people who are really committed. And unfortunately, you know, I've lost a few people in the process. Some of them regret losses, some of them is not. But it accelerated that process of being able to learn that about people.
Yeah. K2, it's fascinating. We have to leave it there, though. I think we've gone on for a bit. But thank you very much for taking time out from a surely harrowing experience to join us this morning.
Thank you.
K2 Mapasa is the CEO of Basil Reed.